Hello, Fuzlem. Welcome to my quick talk about the Matrix Rust SDK. The Matrix Rust SDK is the Matrix client library. This talk will be in two parts. I'm first going to talk about the Rust SDK, how the SDK came to be, how it's designed, a case study, how it's used in Android land. And after that, we're switching to Julian Barber, who will talk about Fractal, a JTK Matrix client written in Rust, which heavily uses the Rust SDK. Before I start, a little bit about me. I'm Damir. I'm from rural Croatia, and since there's nothing to do in rural Croatia, you end up either as an alcoholic or thanks to the advances in technology and art. So I thought to myself, why not do both? Before I jump directly to the Rust SDK, let's first talk about history a bit. How did we end up with the Rust SDK after all? Things first started when I was shopping around for a way to chat with close friends in a secure manner. I was already using WeChat for IRC and XMPP, and I didn't want to change my workflow. The classic XKCD, don't change our man's workflow, if you remember that one. So one could use off-the-record messaging with XMPP, but that turned out to be a bit complex for non-tech friends. For those who don't know what WeChat is, it's a text user interface IRC client, written in C and some 18 years old. It's written in this modular way that calls essentially a chat-specific text user interface framework, and everything else is a plugin. The IRC support is a plugin as well. So you can expand the client to support any type of protocol. Now, there are a bunch of assumptions that the text user interface has that are IRC-specific, so you might sooner or later run into trouble with some different protocols. Here's what we are dealing with. It's a single-threaded program. It's event loop-based and callback-based. Extensions can be written in a bunch of languages. It can't spawn threads unless you're writing your extension in C. It can open sockets for you. This is important. It's opening sockets in a separate thread to not block the UI thread. I have to mention that there already was support for Matrix implemented as a Lua extension, though the end-to-end encryption support became stale. It didn't support the latest version and has had various other problems. I started writing a new extension in Python, and I was a bit annoyed that I couldn't use at the time existing Python SDK. This nudged me towards making sure that whatever I write for WeChat Matrix should be reusable for other weird projects and clients. Therefore, out of WeChat Matrix came Neo, a modular Python client lib with a NoEO API where you push-pull HTTP requests in and out of a state machine and an async API on top of that. Sadly, there are still problems with this, at least for the WeChat use case. End-to-end encryption support in Matrix requires sending out multiple requests in order, which quickly leads to callback hell if you're not using async await, like we can't use async await syntax in WeChat. Another problem is that there's no multi-threading, and expensive cryptographic operations might block the UI. So if you're sending an encrypted message, decryption keys need to be sent out to a bunch of devices. You need to encrypt for each device separately, and this might take some time, depending on the size of the room. And in that meantime, the UI will block. So relatively early on, I started to experiment with Rust bindings for the WeChat plugin API and a accompanying Rust Matrix client library. This leads us now to the Rust SDK. It also has a modular structure. These names here are all crate names, except the state store. This one should become in the future a separate crate as well. You could pick any of these crates and integrate it into an existing client library, possibly in another language, or you could pick the whole Matrix SDK crate and blend it into another language. I should note that we are using Ruma as our input validation layer. It processes all the responses into high-level high-level types, so we don't need to deal with JSON directly. So the Matrix SDK crate here should be the most interesting one for library developers. We are developing a Matrix client library, which doesn't yet support end-to-end encryption. Check out the crypto crate. There's a simple push-pull API. You pull HTTP requests out of the lib and push HTTP responses into the lib. No need to understand the complicated logic of how these responses need to be handled or passed, or which requests need to be sent out when, and how to verify signatures, signed objects. All of that is handled transparently in the crypto crate. As for the Matrix SDK crate, if you remember the code sample from Neo, we mostly retained a relatively simple Python API. Most things should be quite straightforward, and end-to-end encryption support should be completely transparent. Messages get encrypted automatically and, if possible, decrypted as well. Now, this is really similar to Neo. We're using more types, obviously, because we're in Rustland, but all the flow is kept really similar. If you're familiar with Neo, this should be an easier bridge path. But also, if you're not familiar with Neo, it should be relatively simple to write things. Of course, if you're interested in writing bots, this might be a little bit low level for you. So a higher level bot API on top of the Rust SDK crate would be the way to go. A bit more about the data flow in these crates. I already mentioned briefly that we have this push-pull design. And at the top here lies the home server, which has data. The Matrix SDK crate does an async HTTP request, which, as for data, this request will contain an initial state, and some subsequent calls will contain only the delta changes from the previous state. We push the response into the Matrix SDK base crate and into the Matrix SDK crypto crate. And those two crates contain state machines that consume the HTTP responses, update the internal state, and finally generate some outgoing requests. Those requests are then important to keep the encryption going or to keep your state correct. You need to track other people's devices, periodically upload new cryptographic keys to the server, and basically everything that needs to be sent to the server to have working end-to-end encryption support will be pushed out of the state machine as a request that needs to be sent to the server. This does mean that all our networking I/O is happening in the Matrix SDK crate, while base and crypto crates behave mostly as pure state machines. Some persistences there, like data, you're persisting your encryption keys and your state, and so I/O is not pulled out of the crates, but is abstracted away as a trait. Where is the Matrix SDK used? Already mentioned Fractal. This is a high level, probably the flagship client that is using the SDK. It supports encryption, it supports QR code verification, emoji verification. Basically, every advanced feature is either supported or should be supported by Fractal. Widget Matrix IS is my rewrite of Widget Matrix. It has become a bit stale due to lack of time, but eventually it should replace Widget Matrix. We have the Matrix SDK app service crate. This one is built on top of the SDK, and it's used to build bridges and privilege bots for various use cases. Some things only use the crypto crate. Element Android, for example, uses the Matrix SDK crypto crate, and the Matrix Post SDK as well uses the crypto crate. So Element Android is written in Kotlin, and Matrix Post SDK is written in JavaScript, and there are bindings from Rust to Kotlin and JavaScript. Let's take a closer look into how the Rust SDK is used in Elementor Android. Do note that this isn't yet in production, but in a late beta phase. As mentioned, Elementor Android only uses the crypto crate. We're going to take a look at how this is integrated. Firstly, we are using Mozilla's UniFFI crate to mostly generate Kotlin bindings. This is a bit different if you're familiar with Wasm Bungeon and Pyo3. It's a bit different from those crates. You have a separate file where you define your interface, and then it generates Kotlin bindings or Swift bindings or JavaScript bindings or Python, and I think Ruby as well bindings from the separate definition. Our main struct here that we're working with is called the all machine. This is the state machine that handles the cryptography. And let's take a look at the code snippet. This is the first method that we need to bind. This is skipping the all machine initialization, but creating all machine is quite simple. You just pass a user ID and device ID. And if you remember our data flow graph, this method is the push method. It pushes changes we receive from the server into the state machine. So you don't need to push the whole sync response into the state machine. You just push some smaller parts into it. Those are all directly tied to the crypto support. So the two device messages will contain room keys. The device changes are important to track which devices a user has, and the key counts are important so we know which keys we need to replenish from the server. The two device events here will then be decrypted and returned by the all machine, and you can then consume those events separately. Next up is a pull method. This pulls all the HTTP requests out that are either here because we first initialized the all machine or the sync changes produced them. There are a bunch of request types we will get from this. I have not listed them all. It's best to send them all out in parallel, and you need to notify the all machine after each request is sent out. The response needs to be passed back to the all machine so it knows, oh yeah, you sent out this request. One of the requests fails to be sent out, which can happen especially on mobile connections. The SDK will keep pestering you with the request until you tell that this has been sent out. Now, this is a common pitfall with various clients. People tend to forget to retry sending out a request, and oh, that request might have sent decryption keys to other people, and suddenly people can encrypt the messages. So this is a backup plan. If you fail to retry request sending, the all machine will have your back and let you know, hey, you need to send this out. This isn't done for all request types. Some of them are ephemeral after all, but the most important ones, for example, the room keys, the decryption keys, will be kept in memory until you send them out, actually persisted on until you send them out. And that's it. Now you can decrypt room messages. This doesn't happen automatically. We have a separate method for this because we don't know what your user is looking at, and you want to prioritize decrypting the messages that your user is looking at. So you can do that quite easily. Now for the sending side, we need to do two things. We need to establish one-to-one secure channels between each device we're going to talk to. And we need to send each of these devices a room key encrypted using this secure channel. So you first ask the on machine, hey, who doesn't have this secure session? And it returns a request, and after you pass the response to the on machine, almost mostly everyone will have the secure channel established. After that, we call the share room key method, and this will encrypt the room key for this given room and for those members, and this will generate either one request or a bunch of requests, depending how large the room is, and you can send those out in parallel as well. And if you fail to send some of these, the old machine will tell you, hey, you need to send this out the next time you call the share room key method. And that's it. Now you can encrypt messages as well. Well, almost. I skipped one method where you need to tell the SDK which users are part of encrypted rooms so it can track devices users have. But even so, I think this is quite a simple API compared to what you need to do if you implement this from scratch. Let's take a quick look at the performance of Element Android using the Matrix SDK CryptoCrate. If until now nobody has been convinced to use the Rust SDK CryptoCrate, perhaps this will convince them. This has been already explained, but to reiterate, in Matrix Land, to send an encrypted message, you first need to share what we call a room key with every device in the room. To do this, a room key needs to be encrypted for each device separately. And this graph shows how long clients take to share this room key. Now, this isn't an apples to apples comparison since we use different devices, but the slowest device should definitely be the Android mobile phone. And this is the mobile phone, Android mobile phone is the one which is using the Rust SDK. So here the corroded Androids on the graph are Element Android converted to use the CryptoCrate of the Rust SDK. So we managed to lower the time required from minutes to seconds. Now, this isn't all because it's Rust or because we're using multi-threading. There are certainly problems in Element Android, but I don't think anybody uses multi-threading to encrypt room keys, and therefore I don't think anybody comes close to the performance of the Rust SDK. And sharp-eyed people might notice that there are two versions of the corroded Android code base. One is neatly called "What does MATS?" and we'll get to that next. What does this mean? So a bit of a discretion here. And what is what does MATS actually? What does MATS is the creation name of amphibians. Why amphibians? Well, amphibians have some amazing self-healing properties. Like a gecko, you catch the tail of a gecko, the gecko will discard the tail and it will regrow. And because the double ratchet protocol, which is used in Matrix, has amazing self-healing properties as well, implementations were usually named as some amphibian. The original implementation for TextSecure, the predecessor of Signal, was called Axolotl. The Matrix version was called Ulm, or is called Ulm. And what does MATS is a pure Rust implementation of the Matrix variant of the double ratchet protocol. So, why would you ever rewrite your cryptographic library? Why would you ever rewrite anything in Rust? Yes, libOLM was stable and widely used, but let's take a look at the API of libOLM and see why we might not like it that much. This snippet creates an Ulm account. This is basically the identity of your device. Each one of your devices will have its own Ulm account. So this involves a couple of steps. Let's ask Libon how many bytes we need to allocate, ask Libon how many bytes of randomness we need to generate, allocate the memory and generate the randomness, and then call the initialization method. So this is a five-step process, and basically anything you do will have the same layout here. And this shows us a couple of problems with the Libon. It has a weakly typed API. You pass in a bunch of opaque buffers. If you reuse your buffers, you might get a slightly incorrect result. That's hard to notice. So you have your input buffer, you have your randomness buffer, you have your output buffer, and all of those could be interchanged without anybody noticing. This has actually happened to us, where we got a slightly incorrect base64 encoded message. So the input buffer was reused as the output buffer. So the base64 encoder was encoding an already encoded thing. So that was slightly incorrect and hard to reproduce a bug in another library. So all that happened because, yeah, buffers are all opaque and you don't know what you're passing in. And the API is quite complicated. You need to make multiple calls to generate randomness, allocate things, and every binding, language binding of the library will need to, again, allocate things and generate randomness separately. And the next one here is quite dangerous. Asking for an allocation size might return -1, a negative value. Every time you want to do something, you ask the library how many bytes you need to allocate. And there are a bunch of such methods. Some of them might return an error, some of them can't error. If you forget to handle this error, which will be returned as a negative value, you might try to allocate all of the bytes because the negative value will be truncated to a very large value. And you possibly just added denial of service into it, vulnerability into your client. Furthermore, the underlying libraries that are used for the cryptographic primitives, CRYPT25519, ED25519 and advanced encryption standard aren't that great either. So these are just some problems of Libon, but it shows already that we will need to rework a lot of Libon to get it to a modern state. So let's take a look at the WhatDoesEmacs API that creates an account. These snippets are three different languages and all of them create an account in the same way. You just call the constructor and everything gets allocated and randomness gets generated. Now, this isn't really a criticism of C or Libon. At the time, it was probably the best idea to leave the allocations to various platforms. But nowadays, the tooling will take care to use the correct implementation on the WASM in Python or in Rust. And this looks much simpler, right? Bindings become much easier and can have the same high-level API as the Rust version. The bindings also don't allocate or generate randomness anymore. So here's what WhatDoesEmacs offers. You have a much higher-level API. Thanks to Rust, it's easily bumped into different languages using WASM, BindGen, Pyfree, or you name your language bindings straight. We are using modern implementations of cryptographic primitives from Rust Crypto and from the Dalek crates, so X25519 Dalek and ED25519 Dalek, and all of those have been audited. We are also going to audit WhatDoesEmacs, and of course we provide an upgrade path from Libon. So Libon has a way to persist all the object it creates. and what the Zermatt can read the data format Libon uses. We are still not sure what data format what the Zermatt will use, maybe a SerDes-based, or maybe it will use the binary data format Libon uses. And the API is quite similar to what different on bindings were exposing, so it shouldn't take too long to switch to other Zermatts. And this concludes the brief overview into the Rust SDK and what else around it is happening. The rest of the talk will take a deeper look into Fractal, how it works, and how it utilizes the Rust SDK. And this part will be explained by Julian Schwaber, as mentioned, and off to Julian. Bye.
Hi all, I'm Julian. I'm going to talk about Fractal today and the journey of writing it. So Fractal is a native matrix client built for the GNOME desktop. So it follows the design principle laid out by the GNOME design team. It works closely with them. And therefore, it has a huge focus on usability as well as on user experience. So before we dive into the project, let's have a quick look at the project's history. So it was started all the way back in 2017 by Daniel Garcia Moreno, who wanted to build a GTK client for Rust, and therefore he forked Rumor GTK, which now is called FestaIM, written by Jonas Blatte, even though it did not see much development since the fork, actually, or in the last couple of years. But Fractal, on the other hand, got huge attention over the last years. We even participate multiple times in GSOC and Outreachy. Even I have been one of the GSOC students, and later then also as mentor, which was quite fun. And yeah, now 5 years in, so it has been a long time, but now what we are going to do is Fractal complete. I can answer that quickly. No, it's not. We're actually doing something interesting. Back in February, so a year ago, or close to a year ago, we decided to do a rewrite. A rewrite? Yes, a rewrite. But this time with end-to-end encryption support. Fractal, even though we wanted it